And I looked at all the curbside emails I had gotten over the past 3 years, and like 90% of them are about iron deficiency. It turns out iron deficiency is pretty complicated. There's a lot of nuances in it. And everybody else also felt like, oh, I can't bother him with a real consult about this. This is something I should just text him or email him or whatever. But actually, iron deficiency, deciding who needs workups, getting the treatment just right, there's a lot of nuances in it.
That's Dr. Jason Fried, a hematologist at BIDMC and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to the Core IM Thigh Pearls podcast. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi.
And I am Dr. Maria Fernandez, an internal medicine resident at BIDMC.
And in today's Thigh Pearls episode, we'll be discussing iron deficiency treatment. So I'm so excited to get into the Thigh Pearls we're going to be covering today. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Barrel one. Let's do some spaced repetition from the last Core IM Gray Matters episode.
What were the key takeaways on how to interpret iron labs?
Barrel two, choosing between oral and IV iron.
When do we skip straight to IV iron instead of trying oral iron?
Barrel three, considerations with oral iron repletion.
How do you choose between the different oral formulations, and what's your game plan for handling side effects, and when do you check labs again?
Barrel four, considerations with IV iron repletion.
How do you choose between the different IV formulations, and should you be using the Ganzoni formula to calculate the iron dose?
Barrel 5, complications and side effects of IV iron.
When do we say no to IV iron? What's a Fishbane reaction, and how's it different from anaphylaxis? So before we get into iron deficiency treatment, let's do a quick refresher on big takeaways on the last Core IM Gray Matters episode on iron deficiency diagnosis.
So of all the iron deficiency anemia labs that we have, a low ferritin has the best specificity for true iron deficiency anemia.
Yes, and we learned that the ferritin sensitivity and specificity really changes based on what cutoff you're using.
What about 35? Now you're up to 80%, and you're still 95% specific, so it's still pretty good. When you get up to 45, you're now at around 85% sensitive and still 92% specific.
So a good rule of thumb is to use a ferritin cutoff of 50 or less for iron deficiency. But of course, everything depends on your pretest probability and the patient in front of you.
And then another wrench with the ferritin to keep in mind is that we know ferritin's an acute phase reactant. It's going to increase with inflammation. But a lot of our patients have heart failure, end-stage renal disease. They're recovering from some pneumonia, DKA, from some surgery.
Right. The use of ferritin in acute inflammatory conditions is mostly based on expert opinions and also extrapolated from patients who just have heart failure, CKD, and also IBD.
Yeah. At least for now, the current recommendations say go with a ferritin cutoff less than 100 in those patients or less than 300 with a TSAT less than 20%.
And also, Shreya, my other big takeaway from the Gray Matters episode is that there are so many women out there with iron deficiency, but actually without anemia. And some of that has to do with the flawed ranges of hemoglobin and ferritin ranges.
Yeah, and we also sat down and spoke with Dr. Michael Auerbach, a hematologist-oncologist and professor of medicine at Georgetown University School of Medicine, and he had some really good zingers on the topic.
It doesn't have to be iron deficiency anemia. It can be iron deficiency without anemia. I treated a woman today. Her hemoglobin was 12.3, which is normal. Actually, it's normal for women. And that's an outrage. If men had babies and periods, the hemoglobin of 12 would not be the normal hemoglobin. You were made a second-class citizen by the medical society. This actually happened in 1914. This man, Dr. Whitehead, president of the British Medical Society, that said periodic heavy uterine bleeding is a sacrifice that women must make at the altar of evolution. So do your penance. I mean, this was actually belittled. I mean, the fact of the matter is that iron deficiency in women is rampant. Okay, so that's fact. It's a long-standing issue, so it's really time that we address it.
So much to unpack there. You know, I still remember him saying this even months after interviewing him and really wanted to include it. I think for me, it just put this fire in me to do better by our patients. And I've actually made it like one of my clinical goals to diagnose more iron deficiency without anemia. All right. And now with that quick refresher on key iron workup labs, and we all feel motivated to do better by our patients, let's get into all the nuances of treatment. I think our first branch point is often choosing between oral versus IV iron repletion.
So if you read my section in Up to Date, Treatment of Adults with Iron Deficiency, for uncomplicated iron deficiency without active bleeding and without comorbid conditions or without a disorder known to be unresponsive to oral iron or in which oral iron causes harm, I would recommend one iron tablet at least 30 minutes away from food and coffee.
And again, to reiterate, we reach for oral iron in patients who, one, are not bleeding, two, who don't have conditions that make them unresponsive to oral iron, and three, who don't have conditions where oral iron would actually cause harm.
Yeah, but another way to think about it is just to think about who are all the people who right off the bat don't qualify for oral iron and just require IV iron.
Ooh, I like that a lot.
Who are the patients that you can just like jump straight to knowing that they should get IV iron? The first one is like if they've been unable to tolerate oral iron so far, assuming that they've been like prescribed it at a reasonable dose, a reasonable interval with appropriate recommendation. The second group of people is people who are highly symptomatic with severe anemia. So these are usually like the hospitalized patients with GI bleed, or, you know, it's the patient with fibroids and they're like terribly symptomatic. A third category is someone like that who also has ongoing blood loss and you just can't get ahead of it.
Okay, so to recap, there are many buckets to think about those who deserve IV over oral iron. For example, group one seems really straightforward. It's just people who don't tolerate oral iron. But then groups two or three are a little bit less straightforward. We include patients who are really symptomatic or just have ongoing blood loss.
That reminds me, though, of all the people that come in with GI bleeds whose hemoglobin went from like 13 down to 6. And oftentimes people are just happy checking off a box. Oh, we gave them a unit of transfusion. Now their hemoglobin's over 7. And I think some people could even make the argument, oh, that transfusion had iron in it, so I don't need to give them iron.
So one of our reviewers, Dr. Jonathan Berry, actually pointed out that this is a misconception. You see, the iron in the blood transfusion is not free, so the body cannot use that iron from the transfusion to make more RBCs easily.
A good rule of thumb is if they got anemic enough to get a blood transfusion, they probably depleted most of their iron stores. And so even if they came in with full liver stores, right? Like even if this is their first GI bleed ever, they were totally nicely iron replete beforehand, they exhaust that before they get back up to normal. And so that's why such a high percentage of people are still anemic 6 months later, is that, you know, they get back up to 9, they get back up to, you know, 9.5, but then they used up all their liver stores of iron and they can't really go much further.
Such good points. And since hearing this and thinking about how iron stores get really depleted with bleeds, I've been just much more thoughtful about giving IV iron to patients before they leave the hospital.
So we already talked about three groups of people who would benefit from IV iron, but there's actually a fourth.
The fourth category is people that we know will be unable to absorb oral iron. So those are patients who've had a gastric bypass. Other groups like that are patients with celiac disease, patients with end-stage renal disease. Because of the high hepcidin levels, they don't absorb iron well orally.
And as a quick refresher on what is hepcidin, hepcidin degrades ferroportin, which is a key transporter of iron in the duodenal enterocytes.
So when hepcidin degrades the transporter of iron, iron gets trapped in the gut and sequestered in macrophages.
And can't be absorbed by that gut. Womp womp. All right. There's also this other bucket that I think of. I think about people with chronic inflammatory disorders like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, H. pylori infections. These are people that we might also want to reach for IV iron.
Oh, and of course, in heart failure too. We even have data now to back this up from the IRONMIND trial, which demonstrated that patients with heart failure do better in terms of quality of life with IV iron.
Right, right. Is there any data for patients with inflammatory bowel disease, IBD. Like, I'm just throwing out ideas, but I feel like they would fall in that fourth bucket of impaired absorption, right?
And then the last category is people who actually have the potential for harm from oral iron. And that is been described in inflammatory bowel disease that oral iron may actually exacerbate IBD.
The thought is that oral iron therapy can be harmful to the microbiome, especially during inflammation. Oral iron actually really disrupts bacterial diversity.
It sounds like with IBD, iron is actually causing harm and wreaking havoc to the gut microbiome. All right, let's summarize then the takeaways for who would benefit from IV iron over PO iron. I think maybe one way to recap it is thinking about it from the mouth to the gut. So first, thinking about the mouth, who are people who just can't tolerate that oral iron? Then moving down, thinking about the gut, who are people who just can't absorb it well? They have a gastric bypass, or they have some inflammatory state like end-stage renal disease, or that oral iron is wreaking havoc to that gut microbiome, like in IBD, for example. And lastly, looking to see, is there just too much blood loss, right? Maybe coming from places below, like GI bleeds, menstruation, or another source, and we can't keep up with it, and we reach for IV iron. All right, now that we have a clear picture of who's in the IV iron club right off the bat, then for the rest, we reach for oral iron. But here's where more questions come up. One, how do we counsel patients on which oral iron to pick up at the local drugstore? And two, do they need to take it with vitamin C? And three, does it really matter if it's every other day or not? Let's clear all of that up, Maria.
Yes, Shreya. So in terms of oral iron formulations, there are tons, but the punchline is that all of them are similar. No oral iron appears to be superior in terms of efficacy. So it's just best to tell our patients to choose the most cost-effective formulation.
Yes. Okay. I feel like though patients are constantly bringing up like the constipation and the GI upset they get from their oral iron. So maybe are there any oral formulations that are better tolerated then?
They're all about the same. They all cause GI side effects. They all cause constipation. They all make the stool thick, green, and tenacious.
Yeah, so it's just really comical. Like, you look at the marketing for the different oral iron preparations because they actually make all these promises for quote-unquote, oh, there's fewer side effects.
All of the side effects of oral iron are directly proportional to the amount of elemental iron in the pill. That is the only thing that matters. So you'll sometimes see these like supplements that are like natural and it'll be called like easy iron and it'll say like easy on the stomach. And then you'll look closely and it's like, well, it's only got 20 milligrams of elemental iron per pill. Of course it's easy on the stomach. There's hardly any iron in there.
Oh, what a plot twist. Okay, so compare the 20 milligrams of elemental iron in, say, easy iron to the 65 milligrams of elemental iron in, say, something like ferrous sulfate. I guess it's like a balance to strike, right? Giving as much elemental iron as someone can tolerate before they develop side effects.
One thought that I have is that because our GI tract will only absorb a portion of that elemental iron, it makes me wonder if there's an ideal amount of elemental iron to give.
You know, I don't think we know the ideal dose in actual clinical practice. I tell patients to go to the store and buy the cheapest bottle of ferrous sulfate that they can find. And I say, start out taking it once a day. If you get constipated, go to taking it every other day. If you're still constipated, I want you to buy this other thing called Senna. It's also over the counter. But I also give them the reverse contingency. If you're tolerating it fine, taking it daily, you can actually go up to twice a day, especially if you're very symptomatic from your anemia.
Oh, I really love me some good contingency planning, something we can all get better at. Again, this is Dr. Fried's expert counseling. One of our reviewers, Dr. Layla Van Doren, says, you know, for her and her practice is if she's reaching for Senna, she would just go for that IV iron at that point. So everyone has like their own practices.
And then as far as how to actually take oral iron for best absorption, the textbook recommendation is to tell our patients to take iron at least 30 minutes before a meal and also 1 to 2 hours before taking other medications.
Oh, that is so hard. I feel like I've also made this rookie mistake in my own life, right? Like I'm taking my prenatal vitamins, which has iron in it. And of course, I'm like having it with coffee that has milk in it.
Oh yeah. So difficult. Even if you're a chai tea lover, it's just good to know that the phenols in the tea bind to non-heme iron. They form a complex in the gut and they prevent absorption.
No tea, no milk in my coffee. All that being said, Dr. Fried, you know, he did say that in his clinic, he actually doesn't mention all this textbook complex jiu-jitsu timing for oral iron. For him, he just thinks like, for some patients, it's going to be too complex trying to time that iron, and he doesn't want patients to forget taking it all together.
Yep. So we just need to titrate our counseling to each patient and recognize what will overwhelm some patients.
Right. And another important absorption point to keep in mind is to look at that medication list. And of course, PPIs rear their head again. Turns out prolonged use of PPIs or antacids can also affect oral iron absorption.
Oh, wow. So definitely a good time for deprescribing the PPI or the antacid if they don't need it.
Exactly. And I think the other interaction we often counsel patients about is taking iron with vitamin C, or patients even bring that up themselves.
One I will highlight was that for a long time, people said this thing like, oh, iron is better absorbed with vitamin C. And if you look, you're like, where did that come from? You're like, okay, let me follow the paper trail on PubMed. Goes back to this very tiny study. And I wouldn't even call it a study. It was sort of like a proof of concept from 1994 with a small number of iron deficient women who weren't even anemic. And they were just like trying to look at the absorption after getting a single dose. This was not like a clinical trial.
Wow. So this study included 25 women in the 1990s and found a slight increase in just serum ferritin. And now we've created a daily recommendation to have iron with vitamin C for a slight increase in ferritin.
Turns out when someone finally got around in 2020 to publishing a randomized trial of vitamin C or not with oral iron for women with iron deficiency anemia, it made no difference. It made no difference at any time point. Now, look, I don't think a lot of people were out there suffering because they took vitamin C with their iron. I just think it was mostly a distraction. So I say you can still get the cheap one. You don't need to get the one that's three times as expensive that has vitamin C in it.
You know, I do feel empowered going through all this because now I can prioritize my counseling and I can kind of de-emphasize the vitamin C point.
But just a quick note, we may want to point out the difference of taking iron with vitamin C versus orange juice.
Why don't you take your iron with orange juice? The problem is that a lot of orange juice in the United States is fortified with calcium, and calcium actually may compete for absorption with iron.
I really appreciate that nuance, right? And the calcium is the same reason why we say avoid, you know, dairy with iron.
A lot of rules, Shreya.
A lot of rules. Complex jiu-jitsu, as Jason calls it.
Yes. The last thing to dive into is, what is the ideal frequency to order oral iron? Do you tell patients to just take it every other day or every day?
Yes, that's a good question.
This is the most misquoted study in the time that I've been practicing medicine. This is like, it's astonishing how many people change their practice because of a like doc alert.
Oh man, this got Jason really fired up. There is just so much about this actual study that makes you pause.
It was people with iron deficiency without anemia. Why should that make a difference? Well, anemia is an extremely strong suppressor of hepcidin. And so iron absorption is very different if you are anemic versus not anemic.
And actually, this is a big deal because most people that we're treating are actually people with iron deficiency anemia and not iron deficiency alone.
Yeah. And then the other kicker is that the study included only 18 patients in each arm.
Then I ask people, okay, what do you think the study design was? Okay, so in the month of April, people were getting it every other day. They got 14 pills over the course of the month of April. The people who got it daily, what do you think they got? 28 pills over the course of April, you know, every day? No, that is not what they did. They just gave it to people for the first 14 days of April and then did nothing else. They didn't compare to what would be real life, which is that they would take it all the days of the month. And meanwhile, there was like barely a difference between every other day and daily. And the daily people only took it for 14 days. They could have taken it for 28 days. For sure, 100%, I am 100% confident, if they kept taking it for the entire month, they would have had significantly more, almost double the iron absorbed than the people who took it every other day.
So this study asked if taking 14 iron pills every day for 14 days be better, or taking those 14 pills every other day for 28 days be better. Now, we don't know the very real-world question of what's the best frequency over 4 weeks, right? Is it daily, which would mean 28 doses, or every other day, which is 14 doses? And how does that look in terms of efficacy, toxicity, and compliance?
I'm glad we broke all that down, but there have been newer but smaller studies since then. For example, one study recently found that giving iron 3 times per week versus 3 times per day was not inferior.
Yeah, so that was like the headline read of it. But I think for me, the most important finding was that at 4 weeks, people who took the iron 3 times a day, which is also crazy, did have a higher hemoglobin, an average of 1 gram per deciliter hemoglobin higher than the 3 times a week group. So clearly, you get better faster the more iron you give, right? And so I think it just depends on how quickly people want to balance, how rapidly you want things to improve versus the potential iron side effects.
Yeah, for someone who's symptomatic, I might actually reach out for daily iron versus for someone who's not symptomatic, I would probably be okay with giving iron every other day.
Yeah, I think that's a good nuanced read of the literature, and there's not like a one size fits all. I think, Maria, the last thing we could touch on, something that we're not good at doing, is counseling patients. How long might it take for those iron stores to be replete with oral iron?
Can you actually believe that oral iron needs to be taken from 6 to 12 months to fully replete iron stores?
Take it for a year, and you'll have correction of your iron deficiency as long as you're not bleeding and your periods aren't too heavy. And if you tolerate it and take it, in a year, you'll have reasonable iron stores and a correction of your iron deficiency anemia.
Okay, but let's close that loop. If we start oral iron, how do we actually know if there's a gut response?
The British Society of Gastroenterology wrote guidelines in 2021 for the management of iron deficiency and anemia in adults. And like their number 5 recommendation, which had 100% consensus and the statement strength was strong, is we recommend that a good response to iron therapy, like a hemoglobin going up 1 gram per deciliter within 2 weeks, I should be seeing a response of about 1 gram per deciliter of hemoglobin. So if I don't, it suggests that probably giving more is not going to have a lot of benefit unless there's some other reason it didn't go up.
Okay, so you know within 2 weeks or so, and some people do say 4 weeks if there is a response or not, you see that hemoglobin go up by 1 gram per deciliter. But how long does it take to actually normalize hemoglobin levels with oral iron? Caveat again, if there's no further losses.
Hemoglobin will normalize within about 6 weeks, but it takes about 6 months to replete their iron stores. Now, those shorthands, like 6 weeks to get a normal hemoglobin, 6 months to replete your iron stores, those very much depend upon how anemic were you to start.
And so, Maria, do you want to remind us then when we do recheck labs, if we do that, what thresholds we should be looking for when it comes to ferritin and TSAT?
Yeah, Shreya. But again, it really just depends on how anemic a person is to begin with. As a general rule of thumb, we should actually be looking for ferritin levels above 50. Or TSAT levels above 20 after 6 months of adequate treatment.
Nice. All right. I'm glad we covered all this. Let's recap. My big takeaway in terms of counseling patients is asking them, you know what? You can feel comfortable getting the cheapest iron formulation, but just be aware if they make a claim about less side effects, it probably has a minimal amount of elemental iron in it.
Those are great learning points. For me, my biggest takeaway is that the evidence isn't all that strong for taking vitamin C or taking iron every other day instead of daily when it comes to really improving hemoglobin or symptoms. These are the things that we really care about.
Yep. And then technically, we should counsel our patients to avoid iron with food or other medications for the best absorption. Here at Corium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today, we're talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-up room looking way more put together after a night shift, and I knew right then and there they were wearing Figs. Fig Scrubs is made specifically for us doctors, residents, students, healthcare professionals who are putting in long hours and really need gear that can keep up and perform on our level. We have so much going on in any shift, right? Scrubs are the last thing we want to be thinking about. And that's why Figs is great in that they're lightweight, stretchy, breathable. They have all the small touches that have made me a true convert.
They're clean, they're modern, super functional, tons of pockets that I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve Figs. So head over to figs.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's figs.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first purchase. And with that, let's head back to the episode.
No, we have a confession to make. Yes, we started out Pearl 2 with Dr. Auerbach's recommendation for who he gives oral iron, which as a reminder, he said, quote unquote, uncomplicated iron deficiency without active bleeding and without comorbid conditions or a disorder known to be unresponsive to oral iron or in which oral iron can cause harm. At the same time, Dr. Auerbach was pretty real with us about his practice and who actually meets that recommendation for oral iron.
I would say of the 4,000 people per year, that's a real number that I treat for iron deficiency, fewer than 10 get that recommendation out of 4,000. Because suppose it's you. Let's say you had an ulcer, all right? And your gastroenterologist fixed it and it was no longer bleeding. And I'm going to give you a choice. Say, Maria, you can take one iron pill. Take it every other day for a year. And you'll have correction of your iron deficiency as long as you're not bleeding and your periods aren't too heavy. And if you tolerate it and take it, in a year, you'll have reasonable iron stores and a correction of your iron deficiency anemia. Or I can fix you in 20 minutes right now. All done. Take your pick. 20 minutes. 20 minutes. That does what, a year. And it's enormously less toxic.
Okay, I just love this point. And again, I still remember him saying this months and months after interviewing him. And now honestly do factor in how symptomatic someone is and how likely they would benefit from IV iron for my threshold to reach for it.
Yeah, I wish we could give IV iron to everyone, but IV iron is more expensive than oral iron, so we should definitely individualize it.
Ah, A plus for cost consciousness. So say we do have someone with it, we feel comfortable giving IV iron to, we open up the EMR to order it, and there's just so many different IV iron formulations. I know for me, before doing this episode, I just kept ordering the same one that I was familiar with and didn't really have a nuanced understanding of the differences.
So there are 7 formulations in the United States. So you have ferric gluconate and iron sucrose. That's for Lecet and Venofer. They're good. They're safe. They're just as effective and just as safe as the next 5. Now, low molecular weight iron dextran takes about an hour. By the way, in terms of safety and efficacy, no difference. Thousands and thousands of patients in head-to-head studies, no difference. No difference. And they were all compared to iron sucrose, which has the longest history of the standard for safety. Iron sucrose is a good drug, but you got to come 5 times, okay, instead of once.
I had never thought about it this way, but sounds like the main difference is the time of infusion and the number of visits or sittings required to get to 1 gram of iron.
And there's this awesome infographic by Dr. Dexter Wachiku that really helps visualize those differences. But let's summarize here the high-level points.
So my favorite IV iron formulations, of course, are the ones that require only 1 sitting to get to 1 gram of iron infused. That's going to be, for example, iron dextran and also iron derisomaltose. This one is also called monoferric. But keep in mind that monoferric really has a 10 times more expensive price tag to it.
Okay, so that's all the practicalities of the different iron infusions and the cost. What about the side effects?
So this is one good thing. Almost all IV iron formulations have similar side effect profiles.
Nice. That's one less thing to remember.
But there is one caveat to that statement.
I never use ferric carboxymaltose. And the reason for that is that it has this interesting but annoying thing, which is that it stimulates fibroblast growth factor 23. 23 is one of your natural regulators of phosphate levels, and it actually drives your phosphate levels down. For most people, that has no harm, but there is a small number of people who actually have serious consequences from hypophosphatemia. And as a result of that, you either have to check everyone at this like 1 to 2 week interval afterwards when it typically occurs, which means you're bringing them back for an extra visit for a lab check.
So 1 to 2 weeks after infusion, patients can develop something called 6H syndrome. And what is this? So 6H syndrome includes a bunch of things. Hyperphosphaturia, hypophosphatemia, hypovitaminosis D, hypocalcemia, and also secondary hyperparathyroidism.
Oof, what an alliteration, Maria. Proud of you for getting through that. Okay, so it sounds like this syndrome can really lead to life-threatening complications with increased risk of hip fractures, osteomalacia, muscle weakness, even respiratory failure.
Yes. So clinicians should just be careful about patients complaining of generalized weakness and fatigue after ferric carboxymaltose infusions.
Yeah, maybe just best to stay away from it as if possible is my takeaway. Maria, we went over the different IV formulations and it also sounds like all our patients are iron deficient to a different degree, right? So is it like a one size fits all? We give the same 1 gram of IV iron to everyone, or is there a way we can be more thoughtful about how much IV iron someone needs?
There is. So it's the Ghansani formula. I actually use it quite a lot, but it's not absolutely necessary. Some people's practice is just to prescribe 500 milligrams to 1 gram of IV iron.
Yeah. And then I'm guessing there's another group of people who, kind of like you, advocate for using the formula and don't want to underdose patients.
So they're really easy to use. They don't require a lot of like details that are hard to get. So if you just like Google iron deficiency calculator, you will get an MD calc for the Ghansani equation. The reason why I do use these calculations is because people are often underdosed, especially people who are severely anemic. And the problem is, if you weigh 200 pounds and your hemoglobin is 7.5, and normally it's 15, your iron deficit is 2,100 milligrams. You need twice as much. You will still be anemic even after getting 1,000 milligrams of IV iron.
Yeah. And then another tricky thing to bring up that's an evolving conversation is that the Ghansani formula asks you, what's your goal hemoglobin? And we all have to pause here and say, like, for women, do you put the lower limit or normal 12 grams per deciliter, knowing that some of those ranges are flawed and we could be actually underdosing women?
Oh, Shreya, we're all going to be underdosed. Thankfully, some of our discussants and reviewers are writing the new iron deficiency guidelines, and hopefully that will give some nuance to the sex differences of hemoglobin ranges.
Nice, nice. Can't wait for that. All right, last but not least, let's wrap up with, if we give IV iron and if we recheck labs on our patients, when is the best time to do that?
Iron parameters are uninterpretable for the first 6 weeks after getting IV iron. The problem is that ferritin shoots up way above the level that would actually be reflective of your iron stores. And then by around week 6, it's actually reflective of like your true iron stores.
All right. So after 6 weeks of IV iron, we're just looking for a TSAT more than 20 and also ferritin more than 50.
One thing I will mention, because I'm such a stickler when it comes to transitions of care and love deprescribing, is once we give an IV iron, we can feel comfortable stopping that oral iron for a patient.
Ooh, this is something that I would totally forget. So thank you for mentioning it, Shreya. So I think this may be a good place to summarize what I took away from the different IV iron formulations. Basically, they are all similar in efficacy. IV iron formulations that require only one sitting to get 1 gram of iron infused include iron dextran, monoferric, and also ferumoxytol.
Okay, last but not least, should we go over complications and side effects of IV iron treatment, particularly the worry of infection and reactions to IV iron?
Oh yes, this is one of my favorite parts.
Let's get started with a thing that comes up all the time, which is IV iron and infections.
Well, this is complex. There has been conflicting evidence on this matter. If you look at one meta-analysis in 2021, it did find a higher rate of infections in patients treated with IV iron when compared with oral iron or no iron therapy. But oh my God, the studies were just highly heterogeneous and the diagnosis of what infections constituted was not standardized across the trials.
Yeah, great points, great points. And then I think on the other side of that spectrum, right, there was this larger meta-analysis that looked at 10,000 patients who got IV iron, and they did not have higher rates of severe adverse events or infections, which was a win.
That's really good to know. But you know, Shreya, the real pain points just happen in the hospital.
Yeah.
Sometimes we want to give IV iron, but the patient may already have an infection.
I think that anyone who is actively bacteremic, I will not give IV iron. And that is based upon, you know, a very clear pathophysiologic rationale, which is that bacteria like iron, and there's a reason that all mammals restrict the amount of iron in their bloodstream when they're inflamed, because they want to keep it away from bacteria. That is very evolutionarily conserved. However, people have over-extrapolated that concern to being like, anyone who's even possibly at risk for infection or recently had an infection, maybe I can't. If they're not actively bacteremic, the likelihood of harm is extremely low. So like someone like came in and had a UTI at the beginning of this admission, they're not going to have like a breakthrough UTI because you gave them IV iron. No way, no how.
No way, no how. I love that. I'm dropping that on rounds next time. Sounds like either way, it may be good to wait till the end of the hospitalization.
I also don't prioritize it when they're in the hospital with infection early on because they're actively inflamed. So even though you're not worried about absorption of iron, if you give IV iron, you still have inflammatory cytokines that are suppressing hematopoiesis. So you've like given them a bunch of iron that they're not going to use right away anyways. So I sort of wait until they're like clinically better from their infection. And then if I'm like, okay, this person has like significant iron deficiency anemia that hasn't been addressed, they would really benefit from getting IV iron. Like their hemoglobin is extremely low. They're, you know, they're a hospitalized patient. They're not going to be able to tolerate oral iron. They're going to get constipated. It's going to set back their recovery. Those are the people that I will give IV iron to, usually like, you know, a day before their discharge.
Yeah, I really appreciate thinking of the end of an admission as an opportunity to replete iron when indicated. I really still remember a patient that I took care of with heart failure. We gave her IV iron later in her hospitalization, and she was strutting down the hallway saying that she felt so good.
Oh, that always makes you feel so good as a doctor. Okay, so now that we've squared away infections, what about the patients who ask us, hey, like, doc, am I going to get a reaction to this IV iron? What do we say there?
We see a minor infusion reaction, which is self-limited in 1% of patients. I'm not lying. I've given about 100,000 doses since 1981. I've never seen anaphylaxis. Not once. Anaphylaxis is vanishingly rare. It occurs in fewer than 1.25 million doses.
Okay, so anaphylaxis to IV iron is exceedingly rare, like case reportable rare. And what people often mistake as anaphylaxis is really something completely different, a fishbane reaction.
If you give it fast enough, 100% of people will have this reaction. And if you give it slow enough, like if you infused it over the course of a day, no one would have this reaction. But at the rates that we commonly infuse IV iron so that people aren't sitting there all day, somewhere around 5% of people will get this kind of reaction. And then the key thing is, this is not an allergic reaction. It is not IgE mediated. This has been studied.
So if we can shout from the rooftops, a fishbane reaction is not an actual allergy and definitely not anaphylaxis. But what exactly is a fishbane reaction and how do we tell it apart from anaphylaxis?
Patient sitting comfortably about 30 seconds after the iron's given, the flushing occurs and there's pressure in the chest. Might be some anxiety, but there's no stridor, wheezing, periorbital edema, or shock.
And when we see this happening, it's just really important to know how to manage the flushing and also the chest pressure that comes with the fishbane reaction.
We stop the infusion, which is what we always do. We hang fluids and we wait till the reaction is over. And you're going to see that it's going to be over in about 3 to 4 minutes.
You can then turn the infusion back on at 50% the rate, and then they will be able to tolerate the rest of the infusion.
It's so good hearing that symptoms quickly recover after stopping the infusion, and they do not reoccur when the infusion's restarted at a slower rate. But I can see so many people mistaking that flushing as possible hives or that chest pressure and anxiety as shortness of breath.
A lot of people mismanage fishbane reactions. And how do they mismanage them? They will commonly give IV Benadryl. Problem is, IV Benadryl makes you lightheaded, makes you hypotensive, and can worsen Fishbane reactions. So people think, oh, it's benign, I might as well give it. You turn a what would have been a transient, self-limited reaction into a thing where the person's feeling terrible for hours. And then the reaction starts to look even, and then they're like, I'm a little confused. And like, oh my God, this is anaphylaxis. Get the epinephrine, right? So the key thing here is you don't give them IV Benadryl. You don't give them anything. They get better.
Please, please, please do not give IV Benadryl or epinephrine if you ever call to the bedside. It is not necessary and will make things worse. Just stop the IV iron infusion for an hour and restart at a slower rate.
And that is a wrap for today. This episode was made as part of the digital education track at BIDMC. Thank you to all the mentors and everyone involved.
Yes, and if you found this episode helpful, please share it with your team, your colleagues, give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast you use. It really does help people find us. Thank you to our peer reviewers, Dr. Jonathan Berry, Dr. Layla Mondoran. Thank you to Dr. Fatia for the audio editing. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you.